introductions and everything else. And then I know we had some people that said they're going to be running a few minutes late, and by then hopefully they'll show up. So
Jeff, how many do we need for a quorum?
Well, we were just talking about that. I think we need six. Because we have 10 now. So
one more.
When we revisit the bylaws, which we're doing later, I've been reviews and all, just to take a look at them, and we probably want to clarify that because we've got one member now. So
before we start, majority of the members.
You're a voting member, right?
No.
No, you're not. Okay, staff. Okay. Five.
But people are coming late.
But we have two. Yeah. We have two people that, for sure, Andrew and
Don.
Don.
And Don. We're saying they're running late. So, welcome to the March 2nd D meeting. My name is Jeff Riston, Moss Riston, Kristen Holmes.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County Development Engineering.
Nicole Snyder, Clark County Community Development.
Steve Bacon, Clark Regional Wastewater.
I'm Gaither Holmes.
Eric Lino, SJ Engineering.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering.
Matt Herman, Community Planning.
Chris Horn, PA's Office.
Houston Auto, Auto Construction.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Okay. DEEP meetings are recorded. Audio will be posted on DEEP's website. Review and adoption of, well, can you go there?
Okay. We might have to come back to that.
We might have to come back to that. Anyone have any changes?
No, I didn't see any needs for any changes.
All right. We'll come back to that. The annual work plan and report.
Just an announcement on that. Jeff was going intent on that. I want to make sure all the members should have seen a meeting invite to that. Did you receive that? Should be shown for the last Wednesday of March, March 29th, 10:30 to noon.
Yep.
And it's really a nice, I'm not going to say mandatory here, of course, but it's really strongly preferred if you can make that meeting. It just strengthens our presence before the board if all the members can be in attendance to that. So please come if you're able. I think between Don and Jeff, they also sent to the county a final version of the annual report and did include all of the updates and comments that we had as we went along and worked on that together. So I think we're in good shape.
Hey, Greg, just to note, I'm going to be out of town. Unfortunately, unable to attend that work session with the council. So
we'll miss you, Otto. Thank you. Thank
I
you.
Long planned well in advance before your meeting with the schedule. Okay? So we'll
make sure the council knows that a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for letting us know. If you're not able to attend, it would be nice to let us know there. So
odds boycotting.
Well,
because
let's pull back on that automatic membership renewal. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Unofficial version.
Andrew's here.
There we are.
All right. So upcoming events. Andrew's getting signed in there.
Oh, I'm sorry, that would be me. Yes. Okay, upcoming events, full agenda. We're going into full swing here, and that's on the back page of page two of your agenda with Board of County Councilors, work sessions and hearings. We typically will hold the work sessions every Wednesday. Those can begin as early as 9 a.m. Check the county website for actual meetings and times and topics for that. Likewise, BOCC hearings are typically every Tuesday beginning at 10 a.m. with the exception of the first Tuesday of the month. So in March, it puts it March 7th, will begin in the evening, 6 p.m. Specific work sessions, we have speed limit adjustments on various county roadways, Wednesday, March 8th, 9:30. We have another work session on Comcast and CenturyLink franchise agreements on March 22nd at 10:30 a.m. Work session on that's our work session there. This DEEP's annual report, March 29th, 10:30. Another work session on sustainable forestry program that's going into April actually. So Wednesday, April 12th, 11:30 a.m. And finally, a work session on the spring supplemental, Wednesday, April 26th, 10:30. For planning, the commission work sessions and hearings, actually a work session this evening following our meeting. on transportation concurrency management, and Matt and David Jardine are actually going to preview that with us as part of our agenda today. And then finally, a PC hearing on the same topic, concurrency management, the Thursday, March 16th, 6:30 p.m.
Okay. Thank you. Beat member announcements.
Got one quick one. The subcommittee we had for intersection driveway spacing and corner lots, we kind of reconvened and had a meeting to kind of just rehash it out and to get some recommendations over to Jan for the biannual code changes. So that did happen. I think we're pretty much there. And Greg just circulated some draft language earlier today and went good, so we should have moved forward on that.
So that's going to Jan then?
It will, and it should be part of the spring biannuals.
Okay. Any other?
I do. I passed out to you a packet that has information in it from Clark Public Utilities with regards to their spacing requirements, separation requirements for transformers. Typically, this is in residential situations. I've also provided to you the Washington Administrative Code that talks about transformer vault separations. This has, and I bring this to you today because one of the personnel over at Clark Public Utilities has indicated that they are looking to enforce separation between transformer locations, those which we don't necessarily know until, of course, the electrical design is complete, which is usually one of the last things that's designed as far as a subdivision is concerned, and the building separation. As you can see here, the separation between the transformer and any structure, combustible building structure, is 10 feet. The WAC talks about 8 feet. Clark Public Utilities apparently has added 2 feet to that. We don't know necessarily why. The main part, though, is that Clark Public Utilities has indicated and made some kind of determination that cement fiber siding, hardy plank siding, is no longer considered non-combustible. And this is having a significant effect on the placement of structures, particularly on small lots. Where we have the transformer set back from the sidewalk probably 2 to 3 feet, and then we have this 10-foot bubble around it that we know that we can't put a structure within unless it's a non-combustible siding. It should be noted that according to some other research that I've done, I haven't passed out to you, but that I've done, that hardy plank and all and other cement fiber siding is considered non-combustible. And that's the definition that Clark Public Utilities uses with regards to combustible versus non-combustible. Not fire-rated or anything like that, but combustible versus non-combustible. So that is something that's fairly new over the last few months that's come up. It's affected builders having to now change. It's even affected buildings that are already built. The other thing is that this person at CPU has also been in discussions. It's my understanding that they've been in discussions with the county to have these setbacks around the transformers placed as an additional building setback on the final plat, which seems a little over the top, such insofar as you could put a wall around the transformer and you wouldn't have that setback anymore, as well as requesting of the county that they review the electrical plans as part of the plan review to ensure compliance with the setbacks from the buildings to these transformers. I bring this to Deeb's attention because of the fact that there's several things at play here. Number one, CPU has increased the distance for transformer separation to combustible structures, and this is if hardy plank were still considered by CPU non-combustible, we would not have an issue here. But they have made a determination, and we don't know the history behind it, that it is no longer non-combustible, where all the evidence, that at least that I've been able to find, in addition to talking with Jim Muir at the building department, that yes, it is a non-combustible material. This is more one informational, but number two, maybe something that we need to take up as number one a group or pass along to BIA to let them know what the situation is, so that we might be able to maybe get some pressure on CPU to find out what exactly and what their reasoning behind this is. I don't know if there's been a sudden rash of transformer fires that have caught buildings on fire or not, or whether it's being overly safe. I just don't know.
Quick question.
Sure.
Is the 10 foot just from a point, meaning that if you had a non-combustible material at the lower end of the building, let's assume you have a stone base, does the 10 foot, if it goes above that, so it's vertical all the way to the top of the structure?
It's to the top of the structure. Okay. Non-combustible distances are 3 feet. Mm. And so since they've identified, and I don't know what is being
put
used.
But in the lackets, too, right? I think you had non-combustible is 2 feet.
Non-combustible is 2 feet.
They're enforcing 3.
Right, and combustible is 8 feet, and they're enforcing 10 feet separation between the transformer and the structure.
So what you're hoping for is just some influence, because, of course, CPU sets their own rules.
Absolutely.
Public utility, they do.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. This is information that needs to go out there. I don't know if there's anything, any power that we have as a group here that can make them change what they're doing. But I think that there needs to be some pressure on CPU to at least find out where this comes from. Number two, I don't know what other building materials are out there that people are using for residential structures that would be considered non-combustible unless it were some sort of stone, brick, or something like that. What's that? Yes, or steel. Yeah, right.
So their code here, it looks like it has UBC standard 2-1 or ASTM E136-79. So do we know that the hardy plank passes one of those two standards?
We can follow up on that.
Yeah, try to look at that. Because if it does, then they're getting used to their own code.
So, Mike, I've got a couple of things.
Sure.
A couple of days ago, Dean Chaddix started to approach me. He's working with utilities, several different utilities. I think their topic item is joint utility trench.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave him the two next month's dates, April 13th or May 4th, which one works. Long and short, between the group over there, they do want to come in on March 4th. On May 4th to come in. And then Susan Ellinger did lead a group, yes, just today with CPU about the plan review, and having them included and whatnot. So out of that meeting, we talked about the utilities coming in already on May 4th, and they're going to come in and join in the meeting. So we'll have CPU here on May 4th, and I think that they would understand this topic coming forward and us at least having some discussion on it.
Okay.
So. But you know what, Mike? I think your comments are well taken. Just conceptually, I support them. It would maybe be beneficial to open up a dialogue with CPU so they come not just presenting a blank sheet, so
sure,
to speak, but there's already been some correspondence and we can maybe make some progress.
Right. And I know that others that we've been just talking with have had those. I know that Pro Electric has certainly had discussions with them. We'll take a look at what Eric mentioned with regards to making sure that if hardy plank or the cement fiber siding meets these ASTM standards as well as the UBC standards for non-combustible material, then, and it would be good to hear from them as to why this is they're doing. Because this has huge implications with regards to placement of structures on these, particularly these smaller lots. And unless you have the electrical plan done ahead of time, know where all of these are going to be located. And in fact, Prairie is placing this very diagram on all of their electrical plans to say that, hey, you, this is, but it doesn't talk about the material on the building, that whether that's combustible or non-combustible.
Most of the time the eaves aren't, though.
So a lot of times the eaves aren't.
That's the challenge, yeah. There.
And that's where your setback's going to go from, but it's diagonal. It looks like it's not straight up and down.
Yeah. They
actually measure diagonal.
Yes, they, so as far as the whack is concerned, they're
but their diagram is straight up and down.
CPU's diagram is straight up and down.
Yeah, it's a different diagram.
The wax, yeah. The wax diagram.
Which is another big
issue. And CPU's straight up and down.
Horizontal.
Yeah.
Which really doesn't make as much sense to me.
Even if we have hardened plank, don't we run into an issue with our rafter tails and with our fascia being...
Yeah, that's what they were, I think, talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that's where they are.
But it depends. It's how you measure. Do you measure straight over? So if it's 18 feet from there to there, it's 10 feet laterally, it's still it's still within the setback.
It should be a radius, I think, as well.
It is, and that's what the WAC shows.
Kind of a sphere.
Yep, and that's what the WAC shows, but not CPU's diagram. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between what CPU is requiring versus what the WAC is requiring.
So they're going to be at a meeting on this, you said May 4th, is that the meeting?
Yeah, they're coming in here.
Okay. And I think I had a suggestion, kind of giving them a heads up, and maybe we can talk to them about this as well. So
and we'll do some additional research on, I'll do some additional research on this, see what I can find. And if anybody else knows anything more, especially about the materials, that the building materials, would be good to have that too.
So who is this? And can you say, who's contact at CPU? Is it Nick Flagg?
Yep.
So just to strategize about this a little bit, right? Are they coming to inform us, or are they coming to dialogue? Two different approaches.
Yeah.
I will need to, I need to get with Dean and, I guess, pursue that a little bit further.
My understanding with the group that Dean's talking with is they have some issues that they want to bring up and discuss potential
and dialogue,
solutions.
Maybe. Dialogue?
Okay. Might be a different group, though.
Well, I had a utility meeting yesterday, and it came up that they were going to be coming because they've been having some problems that they want to address with Deeb. So.
Well,
here's your heads up.
Have you had dialogue, obviously, with them?
No, I have not. I know that others in my organization have. Like with Prairie or Cascade Electric have had discussions with them on this, because that's where it's been coming up.
Do you want to give them a heads up? Do you want me to give them a heads up? I know Nick.
I don't know Nick, personally. If you could maybe...
I'd give them a heads up and say we're very, very concerned. I mean, to me, a lot of those things are concerning. How they measure it, the...
2D versus 3D.
Take some responsibility. I'm not sure. I saw Chris kind of shake his head on that one. And putting on the plats, that's going to be problematic too.
Yeah.
Transformers get moved, and I don't know what happens then.
Alteration?
Yeah.
So do you have a little bit of correspondence beforehand?
I think I'll talk to Nick, and I don't have to Nick.
In a collaborative
reasonable
way.
Jeremy Electro's replacement.
Maybe end it with, we look forward to discussing this further with you.
Yeah, and hoping that they have some flexibility.
Yeah.
We started to open that door. It wasn't the purpose of the meeting that I was in earlier today, but this came forward we started to, bring that forward somewhat of, hey, we're already going to have this utility topic on the 4th anyway. Do you plan on being there? He's saying yes. I don't think it'll be a surprise to him. So.
It'd be good to understand why they're using guidelines more stringent than the WAC.
That'll be a question for them, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Probably the first question.
Because that solves pretty much everything.
We do.
I know you do. Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a good idea.
Thank you. So let's go ahead and back up. Andrew, I think while you're signing in, Mike, you're coming. We haven't approved the minutes yet because we have a quorum. So anyone have anyone that was?
I'll move to approve.
Okay.
Second.
Second. Any changes? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. I think that brings us to the residential building permits, bonding, and development agreement. So, Chris and Steve, right?
It's somewhat difficult to begin talking about this just from the context of where to go, what the issues are, because it becomes this long, drawn-out discussion. So I'll see if I can give you a Cliff Notes version, and then why I suggested a path that at least right now with Ajo and Clark County we're working through right now. Initially, it was raised by Steve, and it's been discussed before in different contexts. I think this body has heard Clark County, and I think Steve Stewart, a long time ago, promoted getting through plan approval with the engineers being ultimately responsible for everything that went on in a project, and that died a short death. The issue that's presented by bonding for final plat, very early on, because obviously there are several phases that could occur. It could occur as early as the day after you get preliminary plat approval to the date before you record your plat, and everything in between. The problem becomes the earlier, I think it's simple to say, the earlier in that process that you go, there's necessarily more risk because there's less known. As that happens, necessarily the bond becomes more expensive. The county has to assume that if we have to bid it, it's going to be a public work, which means we have to pay prevailing wages and we have to go through the bid process. And the longer the bond may sit out there, the more risk there is because of construction inflation. So what started happening was, okay, what minimum amount do we need to have before we can begin setting an amount? And is that amount 125? Is it 150%? All these numbers started getting thrown out there, but you can see without a whole lot of real wide-eyed thinking that it's pretty clear what can potentially be at stake. And it's very site-specific, because some sites are easier to make predictions, others are more complicated, depending on whether you have steep slopes or whether or not there are any other site-specific criteria. So what happened was, because of the number of unknowns and because this was viewed to some extent as a pilot, it seemed to make more sense that rather than write a code that we didn't have any real experience with and that very likely was going to need or very likely might need amendments early on, it made a lot more sense to start out doing this by developer's agreement, get some sense for what's at stake, what are the parties' concerns, how does it work, and what do we have to plan for, and what are the unknowns. So as you move through from writing the code based on some more limited experience, I know there are other cities in different areas that do this work, but the ones that I've seen are generally on a different side of the mountains from us and have different stormwater issues than we do. And so I found that their proposed solution might not work for us. So what we did and what I did specifically was speak with my client. I spoke with Steve. I talked to him about this as an alternative. We didn't see a downside. In fact, it seemed to make a lot of sense because it would give us the ability to generate the experience and the background set of facts that would form the basis for writing the code, assuming this worked out as well as we hoped it will. So that's where we're proceeding right now. I'm glad to answer any kind of questions that you might have, but I think that the alternative, which is if we try to write a code you will find that it will be maybe more expensive than it needs to be because the bonding will necessarily be on the cautious side. And because of that, the whole purpose of this was to try and avoid unnecessary interest carrying costs for the developers for projects that take longer to get from that preliminary plat phase to the point where they're actually constructing homes. The goal, I think, of AHO, and I'll let Steve and AHO talk about their goals, but my sense is their goal is to do as much concurrent construction as possible to allow them to get houses finished earlier so that they save on interest. With that in mind, as I said, I could not find a faster or an easier way to do this that provided certainty that we needed, or at least reduced the risk, without costing a lot of money for somebody, and maybe just as much as we were saving. So
Chris, your initial plan is a developer's agreement.
That's what we're working off of right now.
So, a little history. I know we brought this up at the BIA's government affairs meeting, and it was extremely well received. It wasn't just an AHO issue. There were several other builders there that were like really happy that it was going in this direction, because most of the jurisdictions they work in have bonding codes. And to tell you the truth, this is different. A performance bond is a little different than a maintenance bond. Maintenance bonds, I've seen a lot of problems with performance bonds. Very rare. Maybe you have different experiences.
It took us 3 years to collect on a maintenance or a performance bond right now from a particular developer on 119th by 152nd Avenue, and we're just now getting the street improvements bill. My experience is, from a municipal standpoint, is that bonding companies are your best friend right up until the time they have to get out their checkbook. Because when they're leaning on the developer, they're great because they can get the developer to do things with threats that they'll never get another bond. But once that relationship crashes and they're looking out for their own wallet, it took me 3 years.
Yeah, no doubt. On that situation, were there homes built that weren't favorably occupied?
Well, the project stalled partly because of the economy. Mm-hmm. The whole project crashed, and then it was bought by Kubitschek. Because there was performance bonding, or because there was a performance bond, they got final plat, and no, there was not home. No, there were not homes built. But Kubitschek's position, probably rightly, was I don't have to build that improvement because it's already been paid for, or it's already been guaranteed, and the plat has already been recorded. So the county was left trying to get the road built.
So what's interesting about this particular case, though, when you're looking at bonding and improvement, and basically you're starting to build, you're pulling home permits, that's another incentive for that builder to finish it out. Because if they don't, they just, not only are they on the hook for the improvements, but they have homes that they really want to build, and they can't get occupancy on those homes until those improvements are built. So that's a whole other, like...
You know, I've been here around here long, too long, because I dealt with Terry Hiller when he used to be Epic Construction. Anybody been around? When Epic Construction went bankrupt, they had subdivisions that were in exactly that situation, and I had to deal with a bankruptcy trustee who wasn't going to do the frontage improvements because of the cost of the estate. And it took us 2 months to convince him he'd never recoup his investment without doing that. And so it's not, while that sounds good in theory, in practice, I can just tell you it falls apart, or it can fall apart. Now, all of this is to say these are not typical. I mean, the occasion I dealt with this one case was not typical. The other one we dealt with, Epic, was not typical. But they happen enough, and the amount of money that's at stake. This one was $500,000. The other one, I don't even know how much Woven lost out of that project, but a lot. And, you know, the net effect is that we had to deal. It took us a long time to finally get those improvements in place so the houses could get finished and that those project or that project could get, the plaque could get recorded.
Chris, can I ask another question?
Sure.
So you're proposing a developer's agreement as a trial.
Right.
What you don't want to do, you're suggesting, let's not codify this process down. There's too many unknowns. History is mixed. We want to figure it out and then do it right as we go forward. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't see. I think that's the path, certainly.
Have you formulated the developer's route yet?
Actually, to be honest, Steve has probably taken the laboring oar. We have a form. We have some sense of what it's going to look like, but I have not done much on it. I've been doing other things.
In your mind, what's the financial guarantee that the county that would be acceptable to the county?
Well, given where
what we proposed, which is similar to what we've experienced in other jurisdictions, we've proposed 125% of everything on stormwater, 150% on stormwater.
In a bond?
Well, yes.
Well, so he's got a problem with bonds.
Well,
can I interject here?
Sure.
I agree with 95% of everything Chris just said. We agreed to embark on this process strictly out of expediency. But it's been my position, remains our position, that RCW 5817-130 bonding statute requires this. There's not really any case. The statute's not been litigated at all, I don't think. Certainly not to the extent of what are the parameters of the restrictions, because the statute's unambiguous. It says local regulations shall provide, in lieu of the completion of actual construction, that the legislative body may accept a bond, and they can set the limits on the bond. There's nothing in the statute that says, well, we'll only bond this but not that. My interpretation of the statute is there's a requirement that the county be allowed, or be that the developer be allowed to bond for all improvements. But that's a discussion for another day. But that's the place where we start from, is that with preliminary approval and final engineering approval, you should be able to bond and start right there. Bare dirt, if you want.
Okay, so in your opinion, what's left to negotiate is the amount of the bond.
Yeah, but we have, for purposes of this particular project, because we know where we're going to be in the project at such and such a date, and what exactly we, for this project, we want to bond for, we're willing to work on this developer.
Yeah. And it's really two parts. It's one, getting the development itself bonded, and two, what infrastructure needs to be in to reasonably guarantee safety of the development before you can start construction problems. So that is the two parts.
But you can see the county's point too, right?
I can see the county's point, but at the same time, I can also argue that having a bond is a safer means than not having a bond, because if you go take a development, start putting the streets in there, run out of money, what's the county going to do now? They have no bond. At least it takes 3 years. They have 3 years to get the road improvement in. There's no bond. Sorry. See you next time.
So what about money, escrow money?
I mean, you can escrow the money as well, but then you're also tying up all your cash. You can get a bond reasonably a lot cheaper, and it's more economical. So if you're talking about carrying costs, you can carry $6 million, $5 million for 90 days, or you can put up a $5,000 or $10,000 bond and start building and paying off that within that time. So in the state of Washington's a little different. A lot of states, you actually have to bond your plat before you even break dirt. And the wording was like that for a long time. We developed in Minnesota. Minnesota's the same way. We bond our plat and record it before you even break ground. I know in the city of Quincy on the east side, there is the east side, but we have a lot of working knowledge with jurisdictions on the east side. We pioneered this with the city of Pasco and the city of Quincy. They're roughly doing the same thing we have in Pasco. They asked to see Pasco's ordinance, and they're going with that. We do the same thing in Moses Lake as well, city of Moxie. So it's something we've worked with other jurisdictions to get in play.
I don't think it's the county's position that we will not accept a performance bond. We have, and we continue to accept performance bonds. What I'm saying is that, I'll stand on what I said, which is the earlier you move into this process from final plat towards preliminary plat, the more risk it takes, and necessarily the more the performance bond would have to be for. I didn't say that we wouldn't accept one, and in fact, as I said, I think we will. And I, even though it does represent a greater hazard than it does if you have a letter of credit or some assignment of account or an escrow. On the developer side, I recognize what happens if you escrow because of the fact if you're cash poor, it becomes a liquidity issue. And I think the county gets that. It's not trying to hamstring development. By the same token, it's got to be reasonable. I don't think we need to resolve our differences. I think the statute, 5817.130, just says local regulations shall provide that in lieu of this, the county may accept. I think we're required to have a process. We do have a process. How we implement that is a discretionary call with the counties. I don't think any developer has an absolute right to bond for a project. The county has discretion in how we implement that. But it's not important to do, and we rarely have refused to issue bonding or allow final plat. Like, as I said, the only issue we tend to have is how early in the process, what has to be in the ground, does infrastructure have to be, do the utilities have to be in, do the first lift of the road, does the first lift of the road have to be on? Now, that's not an issue for us because I think we'd resolve this issue with AHO for right now, which is why this is going, I think this is going to go really well, but those are the only issues that have come up in the past about when the county will issue a bond or allow a bonding of a property to get final plat approval. And then, as you're aware, there's a limit already in the code. All this does get you to final plat, and you can sell lots, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee you the right to build houses. That's a separate but related part of this process, and we're trying to nail both of those issues in one fell swoop because ultimately AHO's goal is not just to get to final plat. They want to start breaking ground to build houses, and I get that.
The important part of it, I mean, I don't want to lose sight of it. I was just stating what I think one end of the spectrum of what the statute provides is. If the county wants to limit it to a certain degree based on risk factors, that's one thing. But, you know, the next issue you're going to talk about here is a code provision that was created that nobody could use. And so I don't want to fall into the same trap of, there's no point going through this whole exercise if we get to a place where, by the time it's been negotiated and approved or the restrictions are so severe on it, what's the point? What are you saving? What are you gaining? So, I mean, I guess that's I'm hoping that, and I'm sure that's going to go that way for our agreement, but I'm hoping as this whole reason we're here is because there's a move to push this into a more code-based provision. And so I'm hopeful that the outcomes are what we're focusing on, both risk for the county, but certainly outcomes for the development. I mean, if this moves production up in the year, which is basically what I think it will do on a general building cycle for the average subdivision, it should move from bare dirt to occupancy. It should move the cycle up almost a full year. And if that's the case, however we craft that code, that's great. But that's really the outcome, I think, where everybody should be looking for this process.
So, Chris, you talk about doing this. This is kind of a pilot based on a development agreement. And I know that Steve's reasoning is to take it beyond that to maybe make it a little more something that everybody would be able to utilize sometime in the future. Where does that leave us now? Are you planning or is it your intention to entertain other development agreements? Because the word of this has gotten out. It's been well received. Are you looking to do, after maybe working through this, to do other development agreements with other builders to do similar things? Or is it, let's see how this goes, and then after that, maybe we can see if we could get it in some sort of code provision included? That's fine. And kind of two parts. That question, and is there maybe then if it does move into a code-based process, is there some sort of performance standard or set of standards that are set up so that you have to have a certain percentage of this done, or you have to have your first lip done, or something like that? Is that where you're thinking about moving to?
Well, I let's say, make one thing clear. I have no say in all of this. All I am is the attorney that gives legal advice to the board. They make the call. So I think that the council's view of this, at least from the limited discussion I've had with them, is that they're going to get through this, get this agreement, or they want to consider this agreement. Whether or not it would be available for another developer, I don't think they would say it's not. But I think they would probably tell you that it's going to be somewhat site-specific because the conditions are different. Mm-hmm. But with that in mind, I don't think the board has said that they're going to wait to see in how successful this is, and until they build their last house, we're not going to sign another DA, because that's not been the circumstance thus far. We've signed probably 100 of them over the last 10 years.
It's for similar...
No, I'm talking about developer agreements in total.
Yeah, I understood there, but I mean developer agreements specific to the early recording.
The point is, yeah.
My suggestion on that is if we can stick to the time, if we can get our act together, get on a timeline, hopefully this will get in front of the council by the 21st of March.
And that's for your DA
that's for my DA, but at that point it will become a public document. So my advice to you or your clients would be, assuming it's well received by the council, you go take a copy of that document, you tailor it for your project, and you submit it as a proposal and say, hey, I'd like this considered.
That's our process every time.
It is, and I think the end game is to get a code provision in, so it's streamlined.
But it may take 3 or 4 development agreements of performance history to see if there's any nuances between how one bonded project works versus
the reality in this economy, they're all going to go right. I can tell you, for years, we never had to worry about elections. We never had a single time when we didn't get paid for anything. And all of a sudden, we didn't get paid for anything.
Then
we had to go through a bunch of different situations.
Are you willing to put your license on?
No. Well, it's not a license issue.
No, I understand.
That came out quick.
Nobody would put their career or their put their annual salary on to bet on this. I agree with you as a general proposition, the risk is low when things are going well. But by the same token, we also know that things happen when you get in the middle of projects. We have cadence, we've had landslides, we've had rain this year and events that we hadn't anticipated. Things just happen.
Broken drill bits.
Chris, on the examples you cited,
that was slow margin.
The example that went poorly that you had to go clean up, were they cleaned up? And did the county lose money on those?
I'm
trying to get to the real risk part of it. What is really the exposure? I see the headache part. We live in a headache world, right? But what did the county lose?
I would tell you that at a minimum, we probably lost 200 hours of professional time at a minimum.
Okay.
And in terms of money, actual dollars spent, it depends. Some of the very small projects that failed, that had issues, we had to go back in and fix them. Stormwater issues where the developer went bankrupt and where it wasn't a huge expense, we just went in and cleaned those up. Those are probably measured in the tens to less than maybe $100,000 on each project. But they cost money. I mean, those are all real dollars that the county spent out on a project that failed because of something went wrong. On the big one, I don't recall what happened with Epic's failure. Really, it was mostly time. I spent a lot of time in bankruptcy court. It's just time.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
Like you said earlier, you've done this a lot. You've been in this business. You've seen the cycles. You've seen both sides of the industry. You really are intimately acquainted with it. You know the cost and the benefits that this will bring, not just to the builder, but to the consumer. Ultimately, to the consumer, this will benefit. Where do you land on this? Are you supportive in concept of what we're, what's being brought forward?
I think, are you asking my professional or my personal?
I want to know, because you said it's not really my decision, I'm going to go to the council, they're going to make the decision. Everybody knows the influence that, that you carry and the voice that you have matters.
I'm just curious where you land on. I think if the public sees a benefit, I mean, I'll be candid, if you ask, I'll say it. If the public sees a benefit, if there really is some connection between the change in the house prices, even if it's a small one, let me give you an easy example. Let's assume you say, we entered this agreement like you do with a federal grant. The federal grant says, this part of this was done by federal grant, or this house saved $200 because of resolution 2017-10-01. And $200 was saved, but there really is a savings that the consumer can say, I got something of that too. I don't think there's a way in the world the board wouldn't support that.
It's obvious.
Home prices in Carrick County
went up 13% last year. If we bring houses a year early to market, that's 13% of the cost that it would otherwise cost those consumers.
Is that only attributable to that?
What does it matter? It doesn't really matter.
I think we need to resolve that issue right now. All I'm suggesting is, I represent the people of Clark County, and that's you, that's all the citizens who work here in one capacity or another. I would tell you there are clearly benefits to trying to do this. There are risks to trying to do this. If you can control the risks and make those manageable and the council feels comfortable with those, I would recommend that the council consider this. But right now we're trying to figure out the management of the risks, and we're trying to and we're working through that part. But I think that in theory, I think this can be a good thing.
Thank you for your answer.
So it seems like we're doing what we need to do. I mean, we're not ready to work on code. We're not ready to do really anything. You guys are working on a DA that may or may not form something that may or may not go into code or lead to more DAs. I mean, we don't know. We got to see what the council and you guys are working on something. So it's maybe something we can pop back into, you know, really quickly to get an update in April if you think that council's going to hear it in March 20, whatever you said.
To Aho's credit, I think you have to recognize that Aho has some credibility with the council. They've been here a long time. They're a long-term builder. I think they're a good starter for this because of the fact that the council tends to be more willing to take a risk with something that's more of a known entity than somebody who's not known. So I think that speaks well of you.
And we appreciate that. I did talk to Mel on this subject because this is...
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah. Mel's done this quite a few times.
We could have brought him.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This is something that the county used to allow, and we would have brought him as well for us to do this. At some point, there was a shift, and couldn't quite remember where it was, and we kind of switched to this. You can build this X amount of models for 20 during the whole process. So the county did allow us at one point to build homes.
I can't remember.
With abundance.
So I don't know when it started.
So, yeah. We've done quite a few homes in Clark County, maybe the most of it together. So we have pretty good knowledge of the county and how the process works here with different stormwaters.
Can we look back to find out whether, because I've heard that before, and in the back of my mind I thought the county did that too, but then
let me ask a clarifying question.
We can look at code.
Yeah.
Yes, you can bond free improvements and get to your final plat.
Yeah.
Does that guarantee you that with a partially improved subdivision, we're going to let 120 building permits out and you're going to build on a partially improved subdivision? I mean, that's the question I have is, yes, we allow bonding, and we've done bonding to get to your final plat, but a phase of your development is not even improved, but you want building permits on that? How am I going to issue a building permit on a phase that has not 1 inch of sewer water, not 1 inch of storm, not 1 inch of roadway? So that's the question.
I'm assuming the DA.
And the proposal we've given is street-based down, in functioning water. I mean, the street base dams, you can assume. Yeah, you can assume.
Sewer too, or not?
Is there a base dam? You can assume. Okay.
Thanks for asking that.
Well, I mean, it's just.
You're going to have utilities. They might not all be finished. You might not have water meters in. All your sewer might not be signed off. But the majority of your improvements are in.
Right.
The street base is enough to get a truck in there. There's no reason for that. If power's not in, that's really not a stopping point for homes. We've built hundreds of homes off a generator. We have one in Pasco right now. I think I'm just waiting for the water line to get functional and the base to get down. And then we're going to go pull 15 permits. So it can be done.
I assume the DA is going to, you're not doing this DA and not being able to pull permits.
Right. No,
so,
that's the goal.
That's right.
So, I would envision that if this were ever became code, you'd probably have a separate provision of additional permits.
Right.
So you'd basically be able to bond and record as soon as you got final engineering approval. That doesn't necessarily apply. Then after a certain level of infrastructure improvement, then the additional permits can be, that could all be
used. And that's how it's drafted.
That's how
it's a two-part system. It's one, getting the plat recorded, and two, what infrastructure has to be.
Sure. When you're applying for building permits, then my risk-reward equation is that, you know, for you to have the reward, the risk has got to be very low for the county, meaning you have to have a lot of your improvements in.
Marty, what you just heard, is that acceptable conceptually, what you just heard Houston describe?
I mean, we've proposed vaults.
Utility transfer lines.
I've seen work in other cities in Clark County.
Okay. Right.
But I've also seen it where a sewer lift station wasn't online, and so lines just charged up, and where's the crap going to go but in somebody's bathroom?
We actually had one that we pumped.
You pumped it for a year. Sure.
They had a vault.
Yeah, we remember it.
But because they didn't get the rest of the line.
And honestly, you know, Chris, I work for the same people. I work for the board.
Sorry. Where do we go on this?
So I think we'll just wait and hear back.
Terry's had his hand up for about half an hour.
So my only thing is kind of like when we talk about on our grading permits, is that obviously I think Steve touched on this, in the code, and I guess just for setting it out, there's expediency. If there isn't a certain level of expediency to it, then it defeats the purpose. So that's important. I see an issue potentially. It works well with production builders where they are funding the builds of the homes. But where we potentially have a custom community where the buyer is financing the builds, that's where we could have potential problems. I'm not sure how you handle that within a code language, but that's where it's not necessarily creates an issue for the county except for the fact that they're going to get upset people who will call the county, and you'll have to deal with those calls. So I see so long as occupancy is not being issued, I agree. If we're bonding subdivisions, then it provides more assurance than you would have had otherwise. And the fact that there's houses adds to that. So long as occupancy isn't issued, and if you stair step those fees, that makes a ton of sense to me as to what level you're at. So it sounds like you're headed in a great direction, and it will translate to savings to buyers. Like Steve's mentioned, time is money in regards to what, you know, that's within a market where obviously values are growing. So it only works within that market structure, and that can change. But it will provide savings to buyers. It will expedite also the lack of inventory, which will help to meet demand, and that we can meet demand faster. And every year that goes by, it takes a little bit longer and slower to meet that demand as far as because of process, and the process gets a little more complicated. So that's another thing that we didn't necessarily touch on that can help to actually push things where we continue to get slower. So this could help bridge that gap in timing of getting the inventory to the buyers. So.
You have to understand that occupancy permits, by and large, with the exception of commercial construction, really are worthless. And not to say they're not important from the standpoint of what they represent to the bank and what they represent to the homeowner, but they're very difficult. If people want to move into a house because it's done, merely because it doesn't have an occupancy permit will not stop them.
It won't stop them now.
It doesn't stop them now. That's my point.
It won't stop them tomorrow.
I agree. That's why you can't put a lot of weight on occupancy permit. Occupancy was important in the 1990s for those of you who were under the Northwest Energy Code, when the county used to give out, or actually I guess it was BPA, used to give out like a $400 or $500 or $900 rebate, but you had to have an occupancy to get. And so our occupancy rating during that time was like 99%. But it's never been that high before, it's never been that high after. And it's just practical.
From a production standpoint, from a production builder standpoint, where these are happening in subdivision, you need a CO, so it's getting...
I agree. Yeah, he was talking about custom construction.
He was talking about custom construction.
I agree. We're talking about a lot of different issues, so I'm not going back to you, and I'm not trying to make yours look more complicated, but there's a lot of issues, so I got to bring it up, because it is a complicated issue.
The custom side, I see problems.
Well,
I see problems.
I'm not sure it's that complicated. It can be done as long as the same infrastructure comes into play, and that's a developer obligation.
It's a timing
the issue for the builders becomes a little bit different, and I think we can generally work through that, or at least I see a mechanism through which we can get there. But
and the plat will be reported, so you will have a legal tax parcel. So
yeah.
For financing that way, as long as you have a tax parcel, you can apply for financing.
And if you have additional concerns, you can tie it to the
process,
right? I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily tie it
up. I'm just thinking of delay of occupancy, though, to the buyer, which has always been, it's always an issue with new construction. So.
Obviously, I'm sorry, I didn't say over from the plan.
Oh, that's all right, that's all right. I'll get over in a week.
So let's, my suggestion would be in either April or May, depending upon, we'll just slip in, depending upon when you have some results. Does that sound good?
Yeah, I mean,
when we actually see the DA talk about what's in it.
Even if it's just the public comment portion of the April, I'm hopeful that we have something in place by the next
meeting. Our next meeting is April 14th. We slid it a week because of spring break, so that's almost 6 weeks.
What do you want to learn?
If we don't have something in place by then, we're toast. It does us no good, right? We're already into the season. So
that'll give us something to look at, talk about.
Yeah.
If it wants to or not. I mean, that's
we had a motion really previously that might need to be amended, because we had a motion already to recommend that we bring this to the spring biennials. So we could adjust our motion. I was trying to think of how to bring this to conclusion, because you know, I understand the stuff that Chris and Marty brought up, very valid concerns, and stuff that we hadn't all thought about together. And like, I think the reality is trying to decide how much of the development has to be done before the county does it, where they feel comfortable, and what the bonding amount is. So I'd hate to see the momentum we have be lost and not bring it back to the table. But if we do it as a pilot project right now and we delay it, it'd be nice to have a set date of when we revisit it.
Maybe you can just revisit it.
Yeah.
You can see how it's going, and we can help monitor it so that you track it.
I didn't remember we had a motion. We had a motion.
We had a motion to bring this to put it on the spring biennials.
So the spring biennials are going to be more like summer biennials.
Well, whatever.
Slip into early fall biennials.
So the spring or summer biennials, are we, I mean, time-wise, do we still include it?
You know, monitor it.
Yeah.
If
the board is embracing this and says, hey, why don't you work on some code language? Because we've seen two or three of these, and we can put something together. Whether it comes in the spring, summer, or in the fall, so at least get some traction.
So the suggestion just to leave it the way it is, and then we go through that discussion?
I don't think we need to amend anything or have a new motion.
We'll make sure it gets on the back on, and Steve and make sure it gets back on to our attention, and we can kind of see what they've worked out. And
it's not going away this year.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't sound like it's going away.
Going to do anything.
It's definitely not going away.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
All right.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Chris, thank you.
Chris, thank you for coming.
All right. So this is on concurrency. That's not my realm.
See you.
Chris, thanks for
coming. Did you just come in to chime in on that issue?
Thank you.
I'm not issuing building permits. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Kristen, I know your address.
I'm sorry. So concurrency code provisions?
We don't have to be in that proverbial flying right now. I can see that happening easily.
I can't. I set that in on the current meeting this week.
Oh, they're upping the speed to 70 on all the roads.
That's amazing.
Sweet. Now I can do it legally.
My name is Matt. But this is coming before you due to a couple board actions. Back in August 2016, the board passed an emergency ordinance to amend this exact same code. In October, they changed that emergency ordinance to an interim ordinance, allowed us 6 months to go through the process of formal adoption. The same code that was changed back in August and October is no different than the one that you'll see today. So this is in front of you for review and your discussion. So with that.
A little bit of David Jardy, concurrency engineer. A little bit of history on the concurrency code that we're going to discuss today. In August of 2010, the concurrency code was written so that development that triggered the concurrency-related mitigation had to volunteer to build or wait for the county to build mitigation to comply with the county mobility standards. Subsequent development that impacted that, that same transportation facility and failure would need to volunteer to ensure construction of the concurrency related mitigation or wait until, again, the infrastructure was constructed. That subsequent development would only have to send one trip to facility to be conditioned with that mitigation. Subsequent development could be as small as a 2 or 3 lot, short lot. The result of that, those very large mitigations being required on those very small developments along the pops that wanted to divide their property, resulted in some concurrency code language that large development projects would trigger the mitigation, then wait out the subsequent developments. Small developments were requested to volunteer those very large concurrency-related mitigations. So to try and help out those smaller developments, we added some code language to the code pre-2010. This is in our concurrency code section G1C that talks about unsignalized intersections. And the bolded, highlighted section is the language that was added to try and help the smaller developments not get tagged with the big mitigations that were being assessed against the large subdivisions or large commercial developments. So I'll just read it. However, proposed developments shall not be required to mitigate their impacts in order to obtain concurrency approval unless the proposed development adds at least 5 peak period trips to a failing intersection approach, projected volume to capacity ratio for the worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay exceeds 9/10 during the peak traffic period, and that same movement is worsened by the proposed development. the small developments were able to apply those new code exemptions to determine if their traffic impacts would be subject to concurrency mitigation to prevailing intersections. Small developments were able to be constructed without having substantial concurrency-related mitigations. The trips generated by small developments would still be accounted for in traffic studies with a 2% per year background traffic growth rate that would capture those small developments. But since that code was implemented, no small developments took advantage of that particular section of code.
David, how did number two, the medium one? Or?
The 9/10.
The 9/10. Okay, I can see that. They took advantage of the other one, though. Okay, that makes sense.
What defines a small development?
I'm sorry?
What defines a small development?
So, typically, small development is a development that would generate, say, less than 10 peak hour trips. So, the actual case that where this language started or came from, or that was the impetus for this code change, it was a 10 lot subdivision with 9 new peak hour trips. The intersection that was in trouble happened to be the one that all of their trips went through. So, in the pre-app, the party line for concurrency at that point, where you have a 10-lot subdivision, 9 new trips, typically would have said traffic profile. But in that particular instance, because we had all of their trips going to the failing approach, and mitigations had been identified and volunteered and required by previous development, that 9-lot short plat was now being requested to volunteer or ensure that those mitigations were in place prior to them being able to go forward as a part of their development. But looking back through all of the development cases since this particular code was put into play, no small developments, 10 peak hour, 9 peak hour trips and less, took advantage of this because there really wasn't any need. There was one case that started this whole thing. Let's see. I do have an example. So, out in the Orchards area, unsignalized intersection is impacted. 88th Street and 94th Avenue. We just did a big capital improvement through there. 94th Avenue was improved. It's like a 3-lane cross-section through there now. In 2010, it was still 2-lane on 94th, and then 88th was stop controlled at 94th. So, proposed development, total peak trip generation, 281 p.m. peak hour trips, 165 entered the intersection. Traffic study findings, development impact to 88 and 94. Out of the 165 p.m. peak hour trips, 5 p.m. peak hour trips were added to the eastbound stop control approach. The level of service on the approach was a level of service F. The volume to capacity on that stop control approach was 0.62. So, you evaluate those things against the code now. The proposed development adds at least 5 peak hour trips to the failing approach. The answer to that is yes, there are 5 p.m. peak hour trips added. Is the projected volume to capacity for the worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay equal to or greater than 0.9? The answer to that is no, it's 0.62. And is the worst lane movement on the approach with the highest delay made worse by the proposed development? The answer is yes. They added one trip that added approximately 10 seconds of delay to that failing movement on the failing approach. So after evaluating their conditions in the concurrency ordinance, no mitigation is required because only two of the three exemptions or thresholds are met. So you take that a step further as kind of the catch-all, and concurrency evaluates the safety at that intersection also. So although no mitigation was required, staff's review of the intersection safety found that only one documented crash for the most recent five-year crash history equated to a 0.09 crashes per entering million vehicles. And a document that I used to look at the threshold for requiring additional evaluation is there. It's the Institute of Transportation Engineers Traffic and Access Safety Access Impact Safety for Site Development. It says that that document says that one accident per million entering vehicles is worthy of additional analysis, and that's where it comes from. That's why one has always been kind of a threshold. Because the crash rate was 0.09 crashes per million entering vehicles, no further analysis is required. So the issues. Current exemption language or threshold language indicates that all three exemptions or thresholds need to be met before mitigation can be required. The projected volume to capacity ratio of 0.9 is very difficult to achieve at an intersection when all approaches are not stop controlled. Because the volume to capacity ratio of 0.9 is difficult to achieve, there may be missed opportunities to require development to mitigate impacts upon concurrency regulated unsignalized intersections. Got an example here of a two-way stop controlled intersection that, and before I show it, if you look at this stop controlled intersection that's here, it doesn't appear to operate very well. It's got several cars stacked there. So volume to capacity. Each approach has an identified volume built into it. How many vehicles you can stuff through that geometry is your comparison. So your volume, your actual counted volume through the intersection as compared to the capacity of the geometry. So there's your volume to capacity. So if you can't move, you're not stuffing vehicles through that intersection. So your volume to capacity stays very low. So your actual counted volume over that geometry is maybe 100 out of 1,900. So even though you have a queue that's a quarter mile long, your volume to capacity could still be under 0.9.
I'm sorry, forgive me for being dense. Could you say the last 30 seconds of that?
Sure.
Let me and to say for that, David, it's something like if there's 100 vehicles stacked up at behind the stop sign and only one enters the intersection, we're only counting that one. That enters the intersection, not the other 99.
It
becomes irrelevant.
Got it. Thanks. Hey, question. But which car is Greg in? Is he going to run that?
Definitely not that green.
Is he going to run that? I'm just curious.
Actually, the last time I played this video when we were doing the interim ordinance, the video ran behind me talking. And evidently, in this simulation, there are some very close calls in here.
Oh. So,
Greg may be in one of those.
Yeah.
So, on the main line, which is uncontrolled, you have a level of service A, very low delay, and they go when they have a clear opening. The side streets, stop controlled, they have very long queues, and they are unable to get all of the vehicles that they actually do have capacity for through that intersection because of the main line uncontrolled.
They have capacity for?
Yes.
Physical lanes? What
that
determines capacity?
The
close.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
It's all about the geometry. The lanes are nice and wide. You can actually maybe even get a right turning vehicle right next to a through left.
Got it. Thank you.
So, but if you can't get the vehicles through those lanes because of the uncontrolled traffic, you can't count the actual volume entering the intersection.
Got it. Thank you.
Oh, jeez.
All right. So now, this next example is a four-way stop control. So now you have everybody stopping and everybody taking their turn moving through. And now you can actually, it's a little easier to look at volume to capacity, but it's still maybe not the right evaluation tool for capacity in an intersection like this. So the queues are a little shorter, but you're actually, because everybody's stopping, you're able to stop the traffic through the intersection. May not be the most efficient way to do that, especially with the kind of volume it looks like that road has, but people are able to get through there.
So, David, just from a layman's perspective, one analysis would be, okay, you count the number of cars that successfully get through the intersection in an hour. And there's X number compared to the previous demonstration, there was Y. And one's better than the other. There's more cars that get through than on one scenario than the other.
So, yeah, you'd have to take that a step further because if you're counting the intersection as a whole,
yeah.
The previous example, you could still have a very high volume entering the intersection, but it may not be coming from the side streets, the stop control. And because of the mainline traffic going through there, it's just flying through there, a lot of volume and all of that. So the volume in the entire intersection may still be very high. So give you a false look at levels of service.
Thank you.
So it sounds like you really just had an issue with the one line in here, that one category.
Right.
It's almost redundant. If you have less than five or more than five to the intersection, right. If you have less than five, well, that's probably the biggest one.
It is absolutely the biggest one.
It's just a straight two.
So, we did get some input from WashDOT also, they didn't necessarily mess with any of the thresholds or the language in the thresholds down here. What they requested the change in is this language up here, the signalization of unsignalized intersections. They wanted it to be more broad because of some of the intersections that are WashDOT owned but regulated by county concurrency could ultimately be, say, a roundabout or some other type of control. So it kind of generalizes it a little bit. So that's where the intersection control or mitigation came from, is WashDOT's contribution. But you're right. In the thresholds, the biggest problem that we have was the second threshold, which is the volume to capacity threshold. So in order to try and still facilitate the moms and pops and not have them be on the hook for very large mitigations that could be triggered by other development, and then the large development waits out the small development, we have, you know, kind of that low threshold of vehicles into the intersection. And so five peak hour trips into a failing approach, and then is the worst movement on that failing approach worsened by the development? So you could have five trips into the failing approach, and the failing approach being a left-hand turn of some sort, but all your trips are going right, you may be off the hook for mitigation at that location. But if you contribute one, and the delay in the intersection goes from 8 seconds to 18 seconds, you've worsened the approach.
But in this case, if you just had one of those trips and it worsens it, you're still on the hook for it, right? That's the model I popped in, I think we were originally concerned with when this came
right. So the way it's worded here, and I think we kept the wording the same, that both of these thresholds have to be met before you trigger mitigation.
It's the and, not the or.
It's the
yes.
And. Right.
Yes.
That's a big piece because, say, let's just use the example we contributed. Even if it's a larger project, but it's so far away that the trips to that failing approach are only four.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't matter if those four make it a little bit worse. It's considered unanimous.
Yeah. Right.
That's so what it stays. We're just taking out the 1.9 because that was kind of redundant and hard to. The rest of the stuff, which was, I think, our real intent remains.
Right. Yes. That's exactly right.
Okay.
And you're right. The larger developments, typically, when you get out that far, then, yeah, they could use it on a failing approach.
Yeah.
But what we were seeing is we were seeing intersections that were within a quarter mile that were being impacted by, number of lot subdivisions that, they contributed five peak trips and they made the worst movement worse. But because of that 0.9 threshold, nobody was ever going to achieve that, so they were able to escape.
So, David, from a practical standpoint, what's the cost to the development on the example you just cited?
It's hard to say, it's significant.
Actually, so...
Could it kill the project?
It depends on what kind of mitigation they need, right? So, typically on unsignalized intersections, the standard line in the pre-app is that... you need to achieve a level of service E, with or without the development. Otherwise, you may have to do signal warrant analysis. But the follow-on to that has always been that you or your traffic engineer can look at other ways to offset the impacts of your development in that intersection, whether that's a lane add, some new striping, maybe a dedicated right turn lane, maybe a dedicated left turn lane. If that offsets the impacts of your development in that intersection, you've met the requirement without having to do a signal. So everything up to and including a signal could be a mitigation component or a countermeasure. So it's hard to say what the cost to the developer is ultimately, because it could end up just being some pavement widening. Or it could be adding a signal.
I remember that means, no, after you.
Sorry. So, kind of looking at this as a fix, is there a proportionate share of traffic impact fee for these small developments? I mean, these are all going to fail eventually. This is a band-aid. And I think there should be, grace given to small developments, but is there a couple questions? Are these intersections being looked at to be put on the capital facility plan for kind of ultimate approval, and are these small developments subject to traffic impact fees, or
yes,
they are? So
they
that's
are.
That's
absolutely.
So that's their theoretical proportionate share towards a solution in the future.
Right.
Okay.
So if it's not regionally significant intersection or corridor, not typically added to the capital facilities plan or anywhere located on the capital facilities plan, unless it's a safety issue, then the county may look at it under a different safety jurisdiction. What we're talking about here under the concurrency ordinance are regionally significant intersections and corridors that, so collector class or higher, at least three legs to the intersection that are regionally significant. So collector, arterial. So when you get the moms and pops that are coming in to these regionally significant intersections, those tend to, many of them tend to be on the capital facilities plan somewhere, or the corridors do, that they use on approach. And again, the small developments, they are assessed impact fees also. Yes. Yes, sir.
I apologize. I have to leave for another meeting, but I do support the proposed language for the record if we're doing a motion. So I don't know if I can give a proxy based on that. Or I support striking that one line. I think it wasn't necessarily needed to meet the intent of the original reason why this came up in the first place, which we dealt with
and I think what's
years ago.
What's yeah. important to remember is that you can, in theory, you can never exceed 9/10 volume to capacity.
So
ever.
Just one and three, I think, would be more important.
Or high, yeah, very high.
It would be very useful. Yes.
So that's what our model does. If it can cut right. proxy and something.
Thank you.
We'll add more
what's that?
That's Matt's job. He's been taking notes back there.
Just a question in regards to a large project, and they have to do something off-site for improvements. And I'm trying to remember, so I apologize. In Clark County, are we allowing then traffic impact fee credits for those improvements that are made?
If the improvements to whatever intersection or corridor you're working on is in the capital facilities plan, and your improvements are non-throwaway, they were going to be a part of the actual capital facilities plan project. Yes, absolutely, they could be TIF credit. Yes.
David, why limit the credit to a project that's on the capital facilities plan?
That has to do with the state law. State law allows us to capture TIF on only stuff that is driven by new development. So we can't, if a intersection is improved that doesn't facilitate the new development, that doesn't abide by the state law that TIF has to be used for new development.
Maybe I'm missing your point, but if there's an intersection that's not performing adequately as a result of Jeff's new project, but he agrees to improve it and thus fix that intersection, why would he not get credit for that, even though it's not on the facilities plan?
Because that intersection might be needed for a safety issue and not for a capacity issue. The TIF is only for a capacity concern for the new development.
We deal with the same thing in the sewer world, and basically you've got your capital plan is how you set your fees. So you have this bucket of projects that you have to pay for, so your fees are set based on
the cost
of those projects. If you start spending that money on projects that aren't on the list, you've messed up your calculation.
You. I get it. So.
There's another, with the concurrency code, we use the concurrency code to measure what projects need to be added to the facilities. It's our performance measure. So that's what drives the new development component, I believe, in
Thank you.
I've got one more question, David. It's just the third sort of exemption, I guess, the one that's remaining. The worst movement on the failing approach is worsened by the proposed development. How is that gauged? I mean, to me, it seems like if you're going to send five more peak hour trips through an intersection, through that failing movement, aren't you necessarily going to worsen the failing approach, or is there some more subjective way to determine if you're worsening it?
So, objectively. That's actually a great question. Actually, when we see the distribution that the traffic engineers put together, a lot of times they will each individual intersection will have vehicles on it, the number of vehicles on approach, and then the distribution throughout the movements in the intersection itself. So, in on that last one, and I can see if I can do it. The worst movement on the failing approach is worsened by the proposed development. So, what you could have your traffic study show distribution at 88th and 94th, where the failing approach is 88th. The failing movement on that approach is the eastbound and northbound left turn lane. But your development is immediately south of that.
I see.
So all of your trips are using that failing approach, but they're all in the right-hand turning movement. Then none of them are headed to left, headed north.
Gotcha.
So it's trying to identify and help kind of clarify where the trips are distributed in the intersection.
Okay. Thank you.
Just kind of housekeeping, a little bit of background about the interim ordinance and the extension that the Board of County Councilors approved for 6 months, and you guys, meeting with you guys is part of the whole work plan to get this thing put together.
Have you talked with other traffic engineers around the area and gotten their take on this?
On the side, I haven't scheduled a meeting with anybody like that. It wasn't supposed to come across like this, but maybe a little bit of frustration over the phone talking to them about this code,
mm-hmm.
And why the reason for change.
Mm-hmm.
I have talked to everybody that I received the traffic study from and let them know that it was coming.
So there's been some public outreach with regards to the professionals that would be using this potentially.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The Charbonneaus, the Kittlesons, the Dave Kellys, and the Homleys, and those folks. They have been actually caught by the interim ordinance in traffic studies submitted since last August of last year, when the interim was put into place by the board, to where they were trying to use that 0.9, and luckily none of the intersections were failing, but they were still showing that volume of capacity. So in discussions, maybe at early issues or something, I just let them know, hey. You're showing this, and that's fine, but that won't be a threshold to possibly remove yourself from any issues if necessary.
And this still protects, I think our main concern is that this still protects the 9-lot short plat, 10-lot subdivision from having to disproportionately improve.
Absolutely.
Fine. Okay. Good.
Absolutely. I think it does. We don't have too many situations like this in Clark County. We've run across two since this interim ordinance, but then again, in both of those areas, we have been noticing some development growth. The Pleasant Highlands area, for one, 139 at 72nd, mm-hmm. It's off control. The Fifth Plain Creek area, right? So when the code was put together in 2010, it really wasn't vetted very well.
Okay.
And I believe that the 9 and 10s got tossed in there as something else to look at. I don't think it was really thought. This is an attempt to try and still protect the mom and pops, as well as those outer boundary intersections. homes that may be impacted by the larger developments also. But get that volume to capacity out of there, that's very difficult to achieve.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
So would we be making potentially a motion then to support?
I would change that.
Well, David, I don't know what Eric did, but yeah.
Sure,
he voted.
I agree. Another chance, another question.
I you can probably go ahead and ask now. I don't think anybody has anybody made a motion yet?
No. Okay. No, I don't think so.
What kind of concerns did you hear back from the traffic engineers?
Good question.
That you contacted?
Actually, once it was explained, you know, kind of where the county was at with regard to that volume and capacity and the stop control intersections, those two-way stop control intersections, they understood completely what I was talking about, in that, you know, you're not able to stop the vehicles through there to get the volume high enough to really get to that 0.9. So a couple of the traffic engineers, as they were putting their studies together in the Pleasant Highlands area and even the Fifth Point Creek area, they did call and ask me, are you, that 0.9, are you really serious about that? And you know, what happens if we get there? So they were questioning that before, because they were seeing that, you know, they were ending up with queues, very long queues at some intersections, and the levels of service weren't that great. But yet they still didn't have to mitigate because of that volume to capacity issue. So they wanted to call and just double check. So there was some outreach from the development community, or the traffic engineers in the development community, that were actually asking that question before I got to where I am today, in trying to strike that second threshold. So I think that the traffic engineering community understands that volume and capacity on an unsignalized intersection like the ones we saw today is the wrong method to determine capacity in an intersection. In a stop-controlled intersection, and that the delay is actually a better measurement tool to identify the problem. So you can actually see queues build up and long wait times because of maybe through traffic or whatever. And that helps identify potential capacity improvements at those intersections also. Why are you perceiving such a high delay at these stop control intersections? Is it because the left turner is blocking the right turn traffic? Nobody can get to the right turn. You know, is that why the queues are building up? How long are the delays? Do we need a stoplight at this intersection to allow these 100 vehicles on the stop controlled side street to actually get out because there's so much volume on the main line?
So, in my words, not yours, but just trying to understand again from a layman's. Oh yeah, Dave. The engineer, typical response was, oh yeah, David, I get it. I can see what you're trying to do. Okay, works for me.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Is everyone okay if we play the lights back on, or do we want to see?
No, that'll be great. That's right.
David, that was nice. Yeah, that was please, great.
Thank you.
Presentation.
Thank you.
The little...
I wanted some suspense in there.
I have to say, though, the four-way,
yes,
that was not a depiction of a four-way stop around here.
Yeah, they don't have that.
Because around here, everybody's going, no, you go. You go. No, you go.
We are too nice.
That was in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I did see two cars that actually, the animation went through each other in the four-way one, so...
So Dave is looking for a motion.
So I would make a motion to approve the code change as suggested. Maybe I'll just move that around that.
approve or endorse,
I think
maybe?
Support. I would second that.
Okay. Discussion?
I think the only discussion I have is that, you know, I think this is a, this probably needs to occur. I still, at some point, would like to see the county move in the direction of rather than requiring one developer to bear the mitigation for a failing intersection, to somehow provide a mechanism to share those costs and spread those costs instead of burdening that one person that kicks the can over to come up with $1 million. I mean, just, but I do support this language. I think it makes sense. It sounds like there was a problem with those developers, so that's all I have.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
We want to say to support the code revisions as presented, or the code language.
What word would you?
It is code language.
Okay.
Code language.
And support works for it?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes our rules are confusing. All right. That brings us to the end, other than public comment.
You scared all the public away.
Yeah.
So, we're out of time, I guess. Thank you, guys.